You're listening to a Bookmark podcast. For rights reasons, we've had to shorten or omit some of the music chosen by our guests, but we hope you still enjoy listening.
You're listening to Bookmark on Cambridge 105.
Hello and welcome to Bookmark on Cambridge 105 with me, Lee Chambers. Welcome back. We've had a summer break. This is our first show of the new series and I have two guests in the studio. Well, not really guests. One is Menna van Praagh, and you are a guest, but you're also my new co-presenter on Bookmark. Welcome, Menna.
Thank you so much, Lee.
We're going to find out all about you in a moment because I did interview you because you are a writer and a very successful writer. So we will find out about you later in the show. But our studio guest today is scriptwriter Steve Bennett. And Stephen, many of you are friends.
We are. We've been friends about 10 years.
At least.
That's fantastic. Yes, so good. So it's a nice, relaxed atmosphere. Steve, you're a very accomplished scriptwriter. When I asked you to send me information, you said, oh, it's all really boring. All you really want to know is that I played football against the Brazilian national team and I've worked with some big names. So let's get that out of the way and then we'll talk about the writing. Tell me all about the football. How come you ended up playing against Brazil?
It was a complete fluke, as most of the things that happen to me tend to be. A total accident, really. I was in Switzerland at the time, and I was playing football. I played semi-pro level in Switzerland while I was out there teaching. But there was a tour of the Brazilian national team. We were just outside Geneva, and they were staying in a hotel, which was near where our ground was, and they'd spotted our ground from the hotel windows and thought, we need to train on there. And they asked if they could use our training ground, and our manager... in a very sharp, perceptive moment, said, yes, you can use the ground as long as you play as in a friendly and we can make some money of it from it and invite a small crowd and so on and so on. So they did. They said yes.
So what was the match?
It was Brazil versus a combined 11 of people who were desperate to play against the Brazilian national team, basically.
But Brazil versus a desperate 11.
That's right, yeah. And all the more desperate as the 90 minutes wore on.
What was the final score?
I think I lost count after a while. It was 1-0 at half-time, though, for them.
That is impressive.
But then they started doing things seriously. And it turned out that one of their best players, we didn't recognise him because, you know, we were saying, that's so-and-so we've seen before, and that's Paulo Cesar, or that's whoever it was. And they had this little guy playing in midfield who was just brilliant, and it turned out he was the coach driver.
No.
So, he was fantastic. So whether he'd been an ex-pro or something, I don't know, but he was the best player on the field.
So they're all star football players in Brazil.
Yeah, sickening.
Okay, and some of these big names that you've worked with, run through a few of them. We might come back to them later.
Oh, I've worked with a few, but I used to do theatre in the States. And the difference between American theatre and British theatre a lot is that Hollywood and the television and film industry tends to close down for... mostly July, August, early September, which is that's the same as here, but the difference is they do something, whereas here it just stops. And a lot of film actors and television actors, but really big names, love to go and do theatre for the summer, and they'll do it for basic wages, for effectively $400 a week, which, you know, when you get somebody like Paul Newman or Gwyneth Paltrow doing that kind of thing, it's quite surprising to... when you're used to the way that English theatre works, you know, a big star system. They don't see it that way over there. And they're desperate to get back onto the stage and do classics. So I found myself, again, mostly by accident, working with people like that, with Gwyneth Paltrow, with Paul Newman, Christopher Walken, Rob Lowe, people like that.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
And,
Paul Newman in particular. I mean, Paul Newman and Christopher Walken.
Yeah, yeah. We did The Glass Menagerie, and I was on... I didn't actually work on that show, but it was part of the same festival. But it was quite funny. One of the few occasions I've felt the need to phone home immediately was when I was in a little cafe in just outside the theatre in the States in summer. And I was sitting on a table that probably should have accommodated about four or five, and the place was quite busy. And a group of people came in and said, I just heard a voice, said, do you mind if we join you? And it was Paul Newman and Joanne Woodward and their kids. So I said no. And even stranger, the next day at almost exactly the same time, the place was still full. And I saw them come to the door and speak to the waitress looking for a table, which there wasn't. There was nowhere free. And he looked over and said, "It's okay, we'll go and sit with Steve."
Ah, you're a first-person
Yeah, yeah. So that was cool. So I had to phone my mum and say, "Mum, I've just been talking to Paul Newman."
Well, we are all suitably impressed by that.
She didn't believe me, actually. But there you go.
Well, we're going to another star now, actually, because your first track is by the wonderful Aretha Franklin. Yeah. Until you come back to me, why have you chosen this one?
I've restricted it to a few musical choices and had to boil it down from thousands. And I was always a huge soul fan. Big fan of Stevie Wonder, who wrote this song, and Marvin Gaye in particular. But I wanted to sort of combine that whole feel of that. Although this was released on Atlantic, that whole sort of summery Motown feel that I remember from when I was a teenager. Made me very interested in great Motown songwriters when soul music, oops, I'm hitting the microphone here, when soul music shifted from being just dance music to music with a social conscience that had a lot more to say, and Stevie Wonder, Marvin Gaye and Aretha Franklin were sort of at the head of that. So, and this one, somehow, I don't know, it's just, if I had to take one single with me to the desert island that we're not mentioning,
then, I don't know what you're saying.
Then this would probably be it.
That's Until You Come Back to Me, Aretha Franklin, the first choice of our studio guest today, scriptwriter Steve Bennett. You're listening to Bookmark on Cambridge 105 with Lee Chambers and Menna van Praag, my new co-presenter, we'll be hearing more from later. We'll also have an interview with YA writer Julian Sedgwick. But Steve Bennett is a scriptwriter, director and teacher. He's written for Emmerdale, Coronation Street, The Royal, Born and Bred and Where the Heart Is. He's directed and taught at the National Theatre, the Royal Shakespeare Company and the Carnegie Mellon Drama Conservatory in Pennsylvania. Those are only a few of the things you've written for. There are other shows in there, including Casualty and Holby City. They're big hitters, those shows, Steve.
Yeah. They were at the time. It's I don't know whether they still carry quite the same weight that they used to. I think there's that drama slot has struggled a bit over the recent years to sustain itself. It's been drama's more expensive than reality, obviously, and so to keep long running series going and to keep finding new plots and not be repeating yourself is quite difficult. And I think there's been a move away, especially from that Sunday night 8 o'clock. Family romantic comedy drama. That's, I suppose, the manifestation of it now is probably Doc Martin. That's about as near as it gets, which is still running. But there used to be that Sunday night 8 till 9 slot, often set in somewhere like on the Yorkshire coast or in the Dales. That was nice to look at and felt kind of warm and safe environment for pre-watershed, and I sort of fell into that category for a while in terms of writing, I suppose because I'd been associated with the soaps.
And is there a pressure? I mean, those are watched by millions of people, big shows. There's a certain pressure that must come with writing for those shows.
I'm not sure the pressure falls on the writer so much, because it's especially writing for ITV, one of the pressures, unfortunately, is to keep the advertisers happy. I mean, regardless of the dramatic content, that if it's not up to scratch, then the advertisers start to ask questions about why the viewing figures are falling, which is now happening with the soaps, of course. That when I was on Emmerdale, I'm going back 10 years maybe. The average decent viewing figures was something like 11 to 12 million, and Coronation Street a bit higher than that. Coronation Street recently had a viewing week that averaged out at 4.9, and that's a drop in 10 years. And it's not all down to multimedia viewing platforms or whatever the expression is. You know, it's down to trying to keep people interested. And of course, what happens is that sensation becomes the big selling point. That you've got to top. If you've had a plane crash 1 week, then how are you going to top that? You know, or if you've had a murder 1 week, how are you going to top that? And unfortunately, the old style of saying amusing things around the bar of the Rovers is less appealing now, or it seems to be less appealing. There's a sense that it might start to veer back, because the experiment of going towards sensation and murder and mayhem and sex and violence in the soaps might just be proving to be a failed experiment, really. And it may well be that people are going back towards that sense of just wanting to spend half an hour with their friends, having a bit of a laugh and feeling better about themselves afterwards, you know, rather than feeling slightly soiled by some sordid goings on that they can't connect with. That was me. That was me on my soapbox for a second. Sorry about that.
But, I completely agree. Let me just say.
Well, yeah. I mean, creatively, is it satisfying? Because you, as you say, you're writing for viewing figures. You're not necessarily writing just for the joy of it.
I think it depends what you're doing. I think if you find something that you can really get your teeth into, that you can connect with, that you're committed to, and that you feel is worthwhile, it's got some validity, then you can really connect with it. And I think, obviously, your writing improves. I'm sure, you know, many would agree in a different format, in novel writing, that if you're not emotionally behind what you're trying to project, then you've no right to expect it to connect with an audience or with a reader or the viewer or whatever. So sometimes if you're commissioned and you don't choose your own episodes on soaps, you get what you're given, even though it may have been your idea. Somebody else might end up writing the episode, and you may end up writing somebody else's idea. And if you can't connect with it or get behind it, then I don't think it's necessarily your best work. And so there is that pressure all the time, which is where that's where the craft takes over, as opposed to the sort of the art side, for want of a better expression, that you should be good enough to be able to communicate the same level of intensity on a subject, because it's such a juggernaut. There's no time to say, you know what, I'm not really into all this. You've got to be able to deliver, and I think that's the thing with the soaps, because it's so fast, it moves so much, is moving so quickly, and it never stops, obviously, by definition. Even with the week, the once a week things like Born and Bred, for example, you've got much more time to develop something and to pull back from things and to say, you know what, that doesn't work, so let's tweak that a bit, let's add something else. Whereas the soaps, you've just got to go with it. And a lot of people can't do it. A lot of really, really good writers struggle with it simply because it's relentless. And constantly having to either think of new ideas or reshape an old idea in a new skin is a really difficult thing to do.
Oh, well, we'll come back to that. You heard me mention Menna, and you've heard her speak. Let's hear a little bit more about her. Now, Menna Van Prague self-published her novella, Men, Money and Chocolate, 10 years ago. 9 months later, she sold it to Hay House, and it's now been translated into 26 languages. The sequel, Happier Than She's Ever Been, followed a year later. Since then, she's written 3 more novels. The House at the End of Hope Street was published by Penguin in 2013, and her latest, The Dress Shop of Dreams, has just come out in the UK, to be followed up shortly by The Lost Art of Letter Writing. I asked Menna to tell me about The House at the End of Hope Street.
Okay, so The House at the End of Hope Street was inspired by two different circumstances. One was that I published my first book, Men, Money and Chocolate. I'd spent about 10 years trying to get published, and I was a waitress after I graduated. You know, it's a struggle. It's not easy to find the time to write at the end of a busy day and you're exhausted. And after publishing, I thought, you know what, if I got really rich from doing this, it would be fantastic to... I had this dream of establishing a house where people could come, you know, and sort of a foundation where you'd get a grant for a year. So artists, writers, actors, painters, that kind of thing, would come and live there for a year and be paid so that they wouldn't have to get a job, so that they could just dedicate themselves to their art. And I thought that would be an amazing thing to give them. You know, sometimes you just need that lift off in order to be able to do what you need to do. And you cut out 10 years of struggling, possibly. And then, so that was just an idea that lingered with me for a while. And then I visited a friend in a house on Kingston Street, which is right near where I grew up. And it's been turned into a house where women can go. It's not a refuge, but they just don't have to pay much rent. It was really a strange, magical experience because the house was incredible. And I literally, there was nothing spectacular about it. And it used to be a bakery, I believe, when I was a child. But I literally did feel as I walked in that the house was hugging me. There was such an incredible feeling. And I don't know if it was because of what the women had created together in that house and that it was really a place, a harbour for them. But it just felt incredible to me. It felt magical. And then when I went home, those two things came together. The idea that I had all those years ago and that the experience of this house, and I started to write.
And interesting that you say magical there. There is an element of magical realism in your writing. Is that how you'd feel comfortable describing it?
Yes, definitely. I first fell in love with magical realism when I read Isabel Allende when I was a teenager, and I read everything she wrote. And of course, you know, South America has got such a deep tradition of magical realism, and I just always loved the idea that there was something slightly magical about life. And it was very different to a lot of the stuff we get here, I think, that's very realistic and gritty. In Southern America, they just almost treat magic as though it's easy, inevitable part of life. Like, yeah, sure, there are ghosts, you know, we can speak to our dead ancestors. And I just thought that was, I don't know, it gave me comfort somehow.
And did you find it quite liberating writing in that genre? Because it means that you can go anywhere. You know, I know you have to create rules within the genre, but you can open a door and find something, a different world there. That's fine within the context of a magical realist book.
Yes, I loved that. It's very grounded in reality. So the protagonist is at King's College and she's, you know, suffering with anxieties that we all suffer. Well, especially I suffered as a student. But then she walks into a kitchen and there's a ghost in the kitchen and she starts having a chat with her. And then I was able to evoke all of the literary women in the house, you know, so you can have a conversation with Daphne du Maurier. Why not?
And did you do research on them? Because there's lots of women there. You mentioned Daphne du Maurier. There are other famous figures on the walls. Did you have to research each of those individually?
Yes, I loved doing that. And so I picked, it was so funny, one time I got an email from a reader saying, this is my favourite line in the book. And it was actually a line of Virginia Woolf's. I thought, oh, okay, great. Because what I really wanted to do was, when they spoke, to use actual words that they said. So I did a lot of research just in their interviews, pieces that they'd written, and then I would write the dialogue and use as much as I could. And that obviously worked because people loved it.
And there are strong women in there. We talked about the paintings of the strong women on the wall and that the central characters are strong women. That is a trait of your work, isn't it?
Yes, I like writing about strong women. I'm writing a new book now and it's the first time I've had a male protagonist. It was obviously something I really needed to explore in my work for a long time. I love writing about women of all different ages. And initially, in the first draft of Hope Street, there was a woman from every generation. And at one point, my agent said, oh, there are too many people in this book. You have to cut some of them out. And I said, no, because I really loved this idea of this magical house that was filled with women. So then I was allowed to sort of keep four of them. And then I really liked to, you know, have one in her teens, one in her 30s, one in her 40s, one in her 80s. But originally I had one in her 60s and 50s, and I love that.
And you self-published earlier works, but this one is with Alison and Busby, main publishing house. Has the experience been different?
Hope Street was first published in America by Penguin in 2013, so they're a much bigger publishing house than Alison and Busby. So I would say that with Alison and Busby, it's been a bit more like self-publishing because they're not so much hands-on. Whereas with Penguin, you get a lot more stuff set up for you. But then, you know, until you're a huge name, you pretty much have to do a lot of it yourself. And everything is about social media nowadays, which is a bit disheartening sometimes for, you know.
Are you not a social media
fan? I'm not a natural. I kind of had to be forced onto Twitter and Facebook and that kind of thing. But you notice with all authors, it's sort of compulsory, unless you're extremely established already and maybe your readership isn't on Facebook and Twitter, that sort of thing. But other than that, yes, it's very much a social media world. And
then, but then you do get engagement with your readers, I guess, when you're out there, when you've got a public profile, which might be quite satisfying.
It's always lovely when someone writes something, and I find it easier on Facebook because you post something and then they write comments. And it's lovely when you say, I'm working on a new book, and you put a picture of your computer up there, and then you get all these comments saying, oh, I can't wait. Oh, I'm so excited. What are you working on? You're like, oh, someone cares. That's really nice.
And you are working on a new book. And in fact, you were saying off air that this one you wrote 5 years ago, of course, it's only just come out in this country. So that's how the publishing industry works, isn't it? Suddenly you have to dig back into your memory to how it felt to write this.
Yes, it's funny because even that it was published in 2013 in America, but that was maybe 2 or 3 years after I wrote it. So it's funny that in the publishing world, yeah, everything takes a few years. And then you're being asked to talk about something, and now you're on my fourth book after that book.
So can you remember, digging back to 5 years ago, because this is your debut novel, how different it was to write a novel to the earlier works you've written?
Yeah, the first two books I did were just novellas. I literally wrote them in a couple of weeks each, just sat down and just wrote for 10 hours a day. And they were very short, they were very simple, you know, one single protagonist, and this was very complex and took me 3 years, essentially, with all the drafts. I wrote it for about 8 months before I sent it to an agent because I didn't get an agent with my other two books. And then it went through ultimately 26 drafts. So it was quite a process.
Yes, 26 drafts. Hard to maintain your interest in, I would imagine, in 26 drafts as well.
What was interesting was that the feedback of the agents was different from the feedback of the publisher. So nowadays, I find that the publishing industry is so different in that you get an agent and then your agent really wants to perfect the work before sending it off to a publisher. Whereas before, you'd get the work and they'd say, yeah, this is pretty good. And then they send it off to a publisher. And then your relationship was really with your editor. And then they would develop the book significantly, whereas now I do so much work with my agents before sending it off, so that my relationships with the editors are not quite so intimate. But in this case, the agent said, right, we want you to cut out half the characters, you know.
Half the characters,
and I was terrified.
That's a big axing, isn't it?
That's a big...
I've got quite personal connections. So yes. I guess you've built up relationships with those characters as well.
Yeah, I still miss them. You know, they were... I was quite devastated, I have to say. Mourned for about a week. And then my husband very cleverly said, well, it's all on computer now, so you'll have your old drafts. And then I did it, and then the agents took me on, and then they sold it to Penguin, which was very nice. Thank you very much. But then I got my editor at Penguin, and she said, there's not enough characters. We need to add one back in. But of course, as you know, you can't just chuck them back in. You've completely deconstructed your novel in order to take them out. And then you have to completely reconstruct everything in order to put one back in.
I did add one back in, but was it the best thing for the book to take all those characters out?
Yeah, I had to be humble. I didn't think so, honestly, at the time. I did it with some resistance. But I think they were right, because it was a more superficial book with all the characters. You know, you literally couldn't go into all of their stories. And so by taking them away again, I could go deeply with Alba and her father. And, you know, slightly new peripheral characters came along on the periphery. But it made it a much richer book and a much more impactful emotionally, I think. And then I was able to salvage some of those characters and bring them back into later books.
So. And as we mentioned, your characters have relationships with pictures on the walls of famous women from the past, writers and famous other women. If you could have a picture on the wall of a famous woman and have a chat with her, who would it be?
I think it would have to be Daphne du Maurier. I don't know that she's my favourite author of all time, but you know when you're young and a book impacts you tremendously. And I think that there's maybe certain ages where you get impacted in a way that you never do again in your life, because you're young and you're ripe and you're open. And I read Rebecca and it bowled me over. It just capsized me, and the writing. And then I remember I got a gift from God in my A-level English exams because it was a critique of the opening of Rebecca. Yes! I was so happy. It was wonderful.
So you could thank her for that if she was on your wall.
Yes. So I loved writing the interactions between the protagonist and Daphne du Maurier. And she said some wonderful things as well that really helped with the book. You know, I think I'd be intimidated by Virginia Woolf, so I wouldn't probably interact with her. And Beatrix Potter, that would be lovely, you know. But so many, so many.
That was Mene van Praagh, novelist and new co-presenter of Bookmarker, talking about her new book, The House at the End of Hope Street. We learnt a lot about you there, Mene. Thank you.
Thank you, Lee.
Our studio guest is Steve Bennett, scriptwriter. Have you ever been tempted to be a novelist, Steve?
Yes, it's finding the time to do it and making that big leap, which is I've never quite been brave enough to do that. Unlike Mene, who's taken that time and taken the risk of putting everything to one side to write a novel. I did write something that masquerades as a novel under the not really under the pseudonym, but I wrote Ken Barlow's novel for Coronation Street a few years ago. It's called The Cartwright Murders. Actually, it's not a novel, but it was supposedly Ken Barlow's investigation into a murder that had taken place in Coronation Street in the 19th century.
He's a man of many talents, Ken Barlow. Isn't
Ken,
he's not getting married.
Ken, yeah. It did okay in terms of its connection. I think it sold in the Coronation Street souvenir shop for a while. But it was a fun thing to do, and I was able to just be playful with it, and I used all old photographs from my family archive from the turn of the last century, and so consequently all my family members bought it because they had pictures of their grandparents.
Oh, I like that. Right, we're going to hear your second choice of music now, which is May You Never by John Martin. Why yeah. have you chosen this?
A few reasons, really. I wanted a singer, an English singer guitarist, because I've one of the things that I spend far too much time doing is playing the guitar. And one of the people who I most admire as a technician, guitar wise, is John Martin, but also as somebody who seems to have an incredible ability to convey a genuine or seemingly genuine emotional quality in both his playing and his singing, which is a real strange thing, because John Martin as a person was probably somebody you would want to avoid for 90% of the time. Apparently he was a lovely man, but had a wicked, vicious temper, and yet he's capable of doing sensitivity off the scale compared to most modern day singer-songwriters. He's got a beautiful gravelly voice and this incredible delicate, subtle guitar technique that nobody else was doing at the time, apart from his friend Nick Drake. So there's a Cambridge connection, I suppose. And I just think he's often overlooked now. He went into hip hop and not hip hop, but sort of electronic music after. But it's his early stuff where it's just him and the guitar and that voice that just does something that very few others that you know. Can achieve, I think.
May you never lay your head down without a hand to hold. May you never make your bed out in the cold. Just like a written song.
You're listening to Bookmark on Cambridge 105.
Yes, this is Bookmark on Cambridge 105 with me, Lee Chambers, my co-presenter, my new co-presenter, Mene van Praagh, and our studio guest, scriptwriter Steve Bennett.
Yeah, I was just thinking, Steve, one of the things I love about being friends with you is that you're always coming up with these new things that you've done that surprise me. I think we knew each other for about 3 years before I knew that you had a band and had albums out as well. And then you were just telling me recently that you're writing an opera.
Yes.
Why not?
Why not? It's not something I've ever thought of, I must admit, until I was approached by an American composer who was looking for a libretto for a one-act opera, something about an hour long. And we haven't really got the process off the ground yet. At the moment, we're just debating backwards and forwards what constitutes opera in 2015. And neither of us are particularly sure. So it's going to be an experimental collaboration, to say the least. It's whether people are more attuned to the sort of Les Mis approach, which is sort of musical conversations leading to big show-stopping set-piece tunes, or whether opera is more in the, more in the traditional così fan tutti kind of style. But we'll probably end up coming up with something, some kind of bizarre hybrid. I've just started writing what I hope is the opening scene, which will be set on a train with somebody being bombarded by other people's mobile phone calls. So that's probably a new one for opera.
Mobile phones.
You've written for theatre before.
I have written for theatre
before. Is it very different from writing for television?
Yes, I think it is, because paradoxically, there are no boundaries in the theatre. You can suggest an idea and the audience is there predetermined almost to go along with it. So if you tell the audience that you're now broadcasting from the surface of the moon, then they're quite willing to go along with that, providing you you don't keep betraying that by throwing in too many curveballs, basically. So the theatre audience is much more attuned to the idea of the fantastic, I think. And so in that sense, there are no limitations. Whereas with television, you've got the image that fixes you to a certain point at a certain time. And even though you can do all kinds of weird and wonderful things, the theatre has much more potential and much more possibility for the imagination, really, of both the performers and writers and the people who go and see it. I mean, you've only got to take kids to the theatre to realise how instantly attuned they are to the idea of being put in a different space. You know, the whole once upon a time thing seems to work, I think, much more readily in the theatre than it does on the TV screen, certainly.
Well, talking about children, thank you very much for that smooth link. We're going to hear from Julian Sedgwick now. Julian's first book for children, Mysterium, The Black Dragon, was published in 2013 and won the Rotherham Children's Book Award. Dark Satanic Mills, written with his brother Marcus, was shortlisted for the Kate Greenaway Medal. His new book, Ghosts of Shanghai, is the first of a supernatural thriller trilogy, and Julian told me all about it.
It's a book that's taken me years and years to write, and I'm very excited about it. I started writing it about 7 years ago with a little pitch to try and get a contract for it. But it took me a long time to find the right voice and the right character to work with. I had been interested in Shanghai for years, particularly this political, historical period of the 1920s, because it's a city packed with weird stuff. You have lots of nations all rammed together amongst Chinese citizens. Many of them are refugees from war-torn countryside. And amongst all that, you have ghosts, gangsters, spies, intrigue, corruption, and people trying to live a normal life. So it's just life lived very large, really.
And why did it take you so long to find a voice and a character? You tried different ones on, presumably,
yeah.
They didn't fit.
I always advise, when I do writing workshops, I always say start with a character. Find your character, your central character, and get to know them, and then find out where they live and what they want to do and get them moving. But this time, really, my character was Shanghai, because I'd been obsessed with this place and time for so long. I wanted to write about that. So it took me a long time to find the character who was going to live in this city. And it transpired that I'd picked the wrong gender to start with for my character. So I had a boy who was running around the streets of Shanghai. And hard as I tried, I couldn't get the story quite to work. That meant I had to take some big decisions.
So your central character is a girl. What, having a girl as a central character, what did that give you that having a boy didn't?
It's an interesting question. For about 3 years he was a boy, and I tried to get him to do and say the things I wanted him to say. My editor felt it wasn't working. I thought it was, and I think he was right in retrospect. As soon as I changed my boy to this girl called Ruby, she started to tell me what she wanted to do, which always sounds pretentious. Authors always say that, but overnight, she came to life, and I could follow her around. And even though she was doing a lot of the same things that my boy had been doing, suddenly it all seemed to be working. Why that is, I'm not too sure.
That's interesting,
yeah,
isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, it's particularly for that period, the 1920s, girls had a less obvious routes they could follow. You know, it was still, even in these kind of colonial places, it was very prescribed what you could do. He would just entertain people and go do polite sewing circles or whatever. But as soon as I had a girl who wanted to do more and have more out of her life and was expected just to be quiet but wanted to be adventurous, she seemed to take wing, really.
And she is very feisty. How was it for you writing as a young girl?
I'm probably not the most blokey bloke, and I've often been told I've a feminine side, a strong feminine side. I quite like to switch roles. I mean, that's part of the fun of being a writer. You want to try and inhabit what it's like to be, whether it's a gangster or a circus performer. Try being a different gender, see what that feels like. But the other important thing was one of the big sources that I was interested in from the start was the memoirs of a girl called Pearl Buck, who was an American who grew up in China, speaking Chinese, comfortable in the Chinese world, with Chinese friends. And I'd read about her about, I don't know, 15 or 20 years ago, and suddenly all of that came back, little pieces of her life, and how strong she was and what strange things she did and coped with.
And what other sources of research did you use?
It's a long story. After university, where I initially studied Chinese, I ended up working in Heffers in Cambridge here and looking after what was then called the Oriental Department, actually a big department in those days. And I bumped into an old friend. She was making a film documentary about China, and she asked me to help, and I started researching Shanghai then, so that's about 15 or 20 years ago. As I delved back into the 20s and 30s, it just came to life, and I wanted to know more about it, and I started to think, I want to write my own story set here.
The city is very vivid. Mm. Did you have a map, an actual map or a map in your
yes,
head?
Oh, yes. I have researched so many maps of Shanghai. I worked on a big film called Inventively Shanghai a few years ago. I had to find historic maps, and it's really lucky having the university library here because you can, they've got fantastic stuff. And I found a map about 3 metres by 2 metres of 1920 Shanghai. So I have scans of that and about every other map, extant map of old Shanghai I could find, because you can't go there anymore. Although there are little bits and pieces in modern Shanghai, almost all of it is gone. And it's kind of important to know where you are and be able to move your characters around.
And in the 1920s, it's just about within living memory, isn't it? I suppose you're always scared that somebody might say, actually, you know, that road doesn't take you there.
Yeah, it's partly that, and it's partly, if you can go to the place, you feel so much more confident as a writer. But if you know it inside out from research, it starts to feel okay. And particularly with Shanghai, it's so important to know where things were because the city was divided. So part of it was an international part called the International Settlement. The French had a chunk of it called the French Concession, where they had their own laws, French law, operating. And then around all that, you have the old Chinese city, which is operating under Chinese law. So depending what street you're on, you're in a very different part of the world. And it's all very, very constrained inside a few little square miles.
And you reference the political situation in the book. Given the age group that you're writing for, how far can you go with that?
It's a really interesting point because it's an incredibly complicated place at the time. There are so many conflicting forces trying to take hold of the city, so you have to simplify it a bit, and you don't want to be preachy and lose a young audience. But when I've been trialling it in schools, it's amazing how many people are responding, particularly to injustice, because I think children have a very strong sense of injustice, a sort of natural sense of what's fair and what isn't fair. And so if you just talk about inequality and show that a lot of Westerners were having a very nice life based on essentially Chinese sweatshop labour, which isn't entirely different to times now. It's just it was very close. So if you looked across the river, you could see the factories where people were working 12-hour days, children working till their fingers kind of got fungus and things like this. Horrible things. And then people having very comfortable lives. So not entirely unlike.
No, not entirely dissimilar to that.
Yes, yeah.
And there's a supernatural element in the book. I mean, again, I suppose, how far can you go with the supernatural element? You want to scare, give children a frisson, but not too much, presumably.
I just judged a local writing competition, and I realised maybe I don't go far enough sometimes, looking at some of the horrific entries that came in, terrifying ones. But I think you can get an atmosphere, and it's atmosphere that's scary rather than anything too explicit. And everyone has a ghost story. Everyone has a ghost story in the family. or even something they've seen or heard. So you can quite quickly tap into that feeling.
Well, following on that, then, are you a believer?
You see, I'm a philosophy graduate, so I find this a hard question to answer. Do ghosts exist? There's at least two terms in there that I think we could argue about. So my position, though, is very straightforward. I don't believe in ghosts, but I've seen some, if you see what I mean.
Oh, that does sound interesting. Did you use any of that for the book?
Only that feeling of the moment when something very unusual is happening and you feel all the hair on the back of your neck ripple and you know that something odd has just happened. Now, you might be able to explain that away with psychology or some piece of science, like very deep frequency noise or something. But you know when something unusual has happened. So I guess I was drawing on that a bit.
And listening to you talk about working in the Oriental section, visiting China, you've obviously got a pull towards that part of the world. Mm. What is it about that part of the world?
I think I was just partly a deliberately obtuse child. So growing up, I wanted to try everything that wasn't being directly offered to me. So as soon as I latched onto stories of China and Japan, I sort of tried to seek all those out rather than the typical Arthur and, I don't know, all the mythology of the West. But also, I think there was something subtle about it that answered some of the nagging questions I had as a child about, you know, what the hell's going on around us, those kind of big questions. I think it was a bit of an odd child. And Japanese TV is largely responsible because they made superb TV adaptations of some of the great Chinese classics. So there was Monkey, which was a version of Journey to the West. And the water margin, swashbuckling.
Course, yes.
I so wanted to be the hero of that adventure. And that led me then towards the culture and the history and the philosophy. So by about 11 or 12, I could be found hiding a book on Zen Buddhism inside my football magazine or Warlord or something.
Well, yes, the way was pretty clearly set then, wasn't it? Philosophy and a link to the Orient.
Yeah, it's nice because I feel I've just stumbled through life blindly, completely, from one thing to another. But then looking back, you start to see things that just have been guiding you all along, a sort of subtle undertow. And if I trust that, it seems to take me to the right things.
And so what's next for you?
There is a sequel to Ghosts of Shanghai coming up, and that will be out next year. And I've just finished writing that, so I've got to start editing that soon. That will be called Shadow of the Yangtze. It follows on from this book and takes our characters up the Yangtze River into war-torn, ghost-torn countryside.
No more ghosts.
And more ghosts, yes.
That was Julian Sedgwick talking about his latest novel, Ghosts of Shanghai, which is a great read. I do recommend it for adults and for children.
So, Steve, you were also telling me that you're adapting, you've done adaptions before, and you're adapting another local author, Jim Kelly's Death Wore White for ITV.
Yes, it's been adapted as a two-part, 90-minute thing. Well, two hours on ITV. An hour of ITV is about 43 minutes of script time because of the adverts. So it'd be about a 90-minute thing. The adaptation's is finished up to a point. It was all virtually greenlit, ready to go, and then the powers that be decided that the second part was a bit too complicated, a bit tricksy, and so they put it to one side, basically, which is not an uncommon thing in television. There are things that have been put to one side and never brought back to the other side, basically. And it was... It's been a good experience. Jim was great. Jim Kelly, who has written two detective series, one Sean Valentine, two coppers who work out at King's Lynn, and the other one, the Dryden series, which is set mostly around Ely, and the central character is a journalist. Which I've done attempts at adaptations of both series, both of which have been with ITV, and it's pending at the moment. There are a few things that we have to wait and see. Things like how long another series might run and whether there'll be a slot for a two-hour drama in the coming months. It's always about time to fit these things in. They only have a certain number of hours for drama over the course of a year. And if they've got a successful series, then they're reluctant to take the risk of putting a new one in. But eventually they have to because they'll run out. So it remains to be seen at the moment. And if the thing is, ITV also makes programmes for the BBC. People don't realise that. It sounds very odd, but ITV has independent studios within its own umbrella, And so if they decide that the BBC might be a better place for it, then they could move it there. So touch wood. It's based, as you say, it's the first novel, Death Wore White, which is a great book. It's a brilliant plot, but for television it's stripped right down. There's so much going on in the book that that isn't in the television adaptation. But it's a good read. Yes, exactly. Yeah.
Writing dialogue for other people's characters? Because obviously you do that, do it in EastEnders, and I'm presuming Doc Cotton's dialogue is very different to Charlie's in Casualty.
Absolutely.
And then, you know, you've got a novel.
Yeah.
You must have an ear for dialogue, the way people speak.
Well, I think one of the things that I do, certainly if there's a great line in a novel, or if somebody has, if you've heard a great line somewhere, you'll try and work that in as best you can. But I know with the way I write that it's my dialogue. I give the characters the voices that I think will connect with an audience, or will form a relationship that that people will want to come back and share next week. So in that sense, I'd like to try and keep it as light as possible. And even in dark situations, I think people try to they try to get through difficulties by banter, by being as light as possible, and also that there's got to be some humour in it. There's got to be some warmth in there, and it's got to be sharp. I think I think people like smart retorts because it's the kind of thing you remember, and it's the kind of thing you might want to use yourself somewhere down, you know, the following day at work.
I had a great experience with you recently when we were writing something together for TV, and I can attest to your dialogue, your ear for dialogue. I think it's one of the hardest things to do, actually, in writing, is to get dialogue that sounds real but not too real. It's not boring.
Yes, and gets the information over, because you have certain facts to deliver as well, presumably.
There is a theory. Well, it's not a theory. It's kind of one of the tenets of the dialogue craft, is that the line, if the line doesn't tell you something about the character and further the plot, then it's cuttable. If it's not doing both jobs, that something in the line is exclusive to that character and enhances who they are and also moves the plot further down into the next stage, then really it's redundant.
Wow, that's a lot of pressure on a line,
isn't it? It is, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it's a lot of pressure on hello, isn't it?
Yes, it is. Yeah. Well, you've got great actors who can deliver that. Steve, we're running short, so we've run out of time, which is a real shame. It's been an absolute pleasure talking to you. We've had some technical problems this morning, so thank you for sticking with us through that. Our next show, our studio guest will be novelist Natasha Pulley. You also did an interview with Laura Barnett.
I did. Versions of Us, which I loved, and I went up to London to interview her. That was a lot of fun.
Excellent. So we'll hear from her, and I'll be speaking to poet Liz Berry. If you want to hear any of the old bookmarks, and why wouldn't you, frankly, then go to the Cambridge 105 website, which is cambridge105.fm, and if you go and find our show page bookmark, you can hear all the past episodes. Steve, we're going to leave now with your last choice, which is Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young, the live version of On the Way Home. Briefly, why did you choose this?
Because it coincided with the time when I was leaving school, and we were all into all things West Coast music-wise, in the Laurel Canyon thing, and Crosby, Stills and Nash were the first band at the time. These all four fantastic singers, great musicians, all coming together, and the other thing, they kind of embodied for a 17, 18-year-old the dream of that notion of America, that there was somewhere out there that was doing this wonderful sort of sunlit, fabulous music. And it was helped by the fact that Graham Nash, of course, was from Manchester, which is where I was from. And so there was that sense of, well, if Graham Nash is out there doing that, then maybe there's some kind of possibility for all of us. So that's why this track.
We'd like to introduce our friend Neil Young.